We're in Psalm 14, and I have a confession to make. I'm so glad we're back in the Psalms. When I started on Wednesday nights almost 7 years ago, we started in the Psalms and did it for a while, and we took a bunch of them, but occasionally I would skip one. Now I'm going back and kind of, you know, picking up the leftovers, the ones that were left behind, and shocking, a lot of them are negative. So I avoided them the first time, and now I'm coming back to them. I will try to make sure that our study of the Psalms are proportional to the tone of the Psalms, so we'll pull in some that are full of joy, but tonight's not one of those. Psalm 14 is almost identical to Psalm 53, and I'm not going to get into, you know, why God did that. There's a few alterations, kind of like two versions of a very similar poem. We'll go ahead and read both tonight, but we're going to study Psalm 14, only seven verses, but it's heavy. Psalm 14, to the choir master of David. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. And literally, the Hebrew says, the fool says in his heart, no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one. Have they no knowledge? All the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord. There they are in great terror, for God is with the generation of the righteous. You would shame the plans of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord restores the fortunes of his people, let Jacob rejoice, let Israel be glad. And then let's go ahead and read the parallel in Psalm 53. You'll notice just a very few differences. One of the differences is instead of speaking of the Lord, all caps, Jehovah, it speaks of God. And then there's a couple very minor expansions. Psalm 53, to the choir master, according to Mahalath, a Maskil of David. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, doing abominable iniquity. There is none who does good. God looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all fallen away. Together they have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one. Have those who work evil no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon God? There they are in great terror where there is no terror. For God scatters the bones of him who encamps against you. You put them to shame, for God has rejected them. And you can see verse 5 is essentially an expansion. And then verse 6. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. When God restores the fortunes of his people, let Jacob rejoice, let Israel be glad. All right, back to Psalm 14. That's where we'll camp for a few minutes. Well, when we initially did this series, I would always start by asking for your feedback on two questions. The first is, what is the setting of this psalm? You know, what's the circumstance? Occasionally we'll know that, you know, David is looking over his sheep, or he's looking at the heavens, or he's hiding out. You know, sometimes we're told what's the circumstance. Here we're not given a specific instance, but what's the sense that you get? What's happening here? Anyone? All right.
The fool says there's no God. Look what God has done.
Well, I think there's actually like he wants Israel to have a victory over someone. But I think they're actually in a place where they are suffering some kind of setback, some kind of defeat. And he talks about the wicked, you know, devouring the people of God like bread, which is very picturesque. I think they've suffered some defeat. And now he's saying in verse 7, "Oh God, I can't wait till you fix this, and then your people will rejoice." Now I'm trying to figure out when that would be in his life. Yeah. Yeah, maybe the idea is Saul is king, so David's a young man. Because for the most part, not exclusively, but for the most part, when David was king, they won. You know, I mean, David is, what they say, Saul has slain his thousands, but David is tens of thousands. And David just expanded the kingdom at every turn. Most of the setbacks, like to the Philistines, were before he became king, or when he was exiled and running, and Saul's weakness, you know, was very evident. And it would make sense to me that it might be early. I actually put in my notes that, you know, possibly early in his life before he was king. We don't know. We do know Israel's in trouble, and David is worried about it. And that's so typical of David. Goliath's yelling, and David is exercised that God would answer this uncircumcised Philistine and close his blasphemous mouth. And that's kind of what you see here as well. All right. And then this one, I think, should be a little bit easier or a little bit more objective. What is the tone of the psalm? What's the mood of the psalm? Huh? Yeah, it definitely has some imprecation. An imprecatory psalm is where the psalmist is praying, "God, sick 'em. Go get him. I can't wait." Now this one is not as, you know, not as graphic as some. He doesn't pray for God to break somebody's jaw like he will elsewhere. But there is. Do you remember Psalm 6? We talked about how the psalmist was sad. Does David sound sad to you? I think he's mad. You know, I think he's not moping. He's angry. He's frustrated that the wicked are blaspheming God. And he's kind of looking forward to their judgment. So there is that tone of imprecation in there. But he also sounds, beyond just, you know, fighting and being worried about Israel, David is looking at humanity. And what is his verdict when he looks at humanity? What is God's verdict through David when he looks at humanity?
Romans 3.
Yeah. I was going to ask, is this passage familiar to you? It should be, because it's quoted by Paul in Romans 3, 10 through 12. When Paul has said, Jews are under sin, Gentiles are under sin, everybody's under sin. And he quotes from this psalm and a few more psalms and then a proverb. So the first, say, three verses are quoted almost directly in Romans 3, 10 through 12. David is almost like a prosecuting attorney, and he's indicting the atheist, you know, the fool who says there's no God. But he's not just fixating on the fool, like there's one person. Because by the time he moves on from verse 1, he says, the fool has said in his heart there is no God. And then he says, they are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none who does good. So he's just moved from one fool that he's mad at, whoever that may be, Saul, I don't know. But he moved from that guy to just generalize on humanity. And he is condemning the wicked. And he's also taking up the cause of God and of the godly, the oppressed, and longing for a turn. Stephen Lawson calls this a dirge on depravity. So there's kind of a sadness, but his dander's up. I think it's a little bit more maybe angry than that. All right, we're going to look first at verse 1. And there's a point at which if you get verse 1, the rest of it is just details. Verse 1, the fool says in his heart, there is no God, and King James would italicize "there is." The fool says in his heart, "No God." And then he broadens out, "They are corrupt, do abominable deeds. There is none who does good." All right, we have a professing atheist, and he might not actually be philosophically denying the existence of God, but whether he believes God exists or not, he doesn't believe God is relevant. So if he's not an atheist, he's an agnostic, a practical atheist. You know, we have a lot of people that would sing "God Bless America," but they live like there is no God and there's no accountability. So that's what's in his heart. What do we know about the fool from our studies in Proverbs? Remind me, who is the fool? All right, he's not goofy. You know, he's not just dumb. That's not the fool in Proverbs. That's goofy. Who's the fool in Proverbs? And you see a hint of it here.
He turns his back on wisdom.
It's not, he might be really smart. Okay, but his problem is an intellect. What's his problem? His pride, his heart, you know, his will. Okay, and we've gone through in the Proverbs study, we went through, there's actually kind of different grades of fool. You have the simpleton. That would be like a kid who doesn't know better and he's deciding. And then you have the fool, and that's kind of the run-of-the-mill average God rejecter. And then if he doesn't eventually turn, then he graduates to what? The simpleton will become a fool. The fool will become a scorner or a scoffer. And that you actually see, like, he's got a sneering lip. He's, you know, when we start out chapter 14, verse 1, that's a scorner, probably. There's no God. Okay, so it's about his heart, not his intellect. Basically, he's the natural man. He's the lost man. He is mankind left to his own devices. There's a sense in which this is every man. Okay, you're not supposed to look at chapter 14 and say, "Wow, that guy must have been terrible. Maybe it was Goliath, you know, or King Saul." No, it's actually, it's general enough to be everybody. And again, we're going to get there by the end of verse 1. There's nobody good. Everybody is born a fool. So every sinner born since the fall has been born kind of a, what Jim Burke calls a budding fool, the simpleton. They're born with an anti-God bent. So it's always been true, but boy, in the modern age, like, this is reading the newspaper. Don't we live in a world where people are perpetually, you think of the skeptic, you think of the scientist, you know, Hawking or whoever it might be, so brilliant, and they've explained away God, and, you know, we definitely live in a world where that is happening in living color. I'm reading a book by G. Gresham Machen, and it's called Christianity and Liberalism, and he's talking about liberal Christianity, but even his title is very kind of sword-rattling. Liberalism is not Christianity. He makes two categories. There's Christianity and there's what you guys believe. You deny the resurrection, that's not Christianity. You deny the virgin birth, that's not Christianity. And he's talking about these people who seem to be so pious and trying to be smart and trying to rescue the Bible from, you know, people like us. And he says, no, you're arrogant and you're wicked and you're Psalm 14. Okay, so his identity is he's hard-hearted, he's a sinner. And what do you get from the fact that he doesn't just say there is no God? You know, you could say, the fool has said there is no God. But I left out a phrase, the fool has said in his heart. What does that tell you about him? The fool has said in his heart there is no God. What does that add to our understanding of the sinner?
Willful.
It is willful. He's not just boasting. He's not just, you know, kind of playing to a crowd. This hatred of God is who he is. Okay, often you'll hear people say like, well, I think people are basically good, but they do some bad things. And this says, no, this antagonism to God comes right out of the heart. The fool has said in his heart, there's no God. And again, you might be prone to say like that, that's terrible. People are terrible. Yeah, but then he says, they are corrupt. Okay, and the idea of corrupt is rotten, spoiled. It sounds a lot like Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can know it? That's the condition of the heart. They're corrupt and they do abominable deeds. I know it's Wednesday night, long day, long week. So I don't blame you if you're, you know, not focused. Give me a second. The move when he says they are corrupt, they do abominable deeds. He just made a progression. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. What are we supposed to be getting from that? This is reprobation. This is what reprobation. This is at least depravity. And they could very well get to the point of being the scorn of the reprobate. But this is depravity. Right? You always hear the question like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Alright? What came first, the sinner or the sin?
You do what you do because you are what you are.
You do what you do because you are what you are. See, you're not a sinner because you have sinned. Okay, that actually would be kind of a really aggressive Arminianism. What's the term I'm looking for history? It'd be a really aggressive early Arminianism, and it starts with P. Pelagianism. All right, that, you know, you're kind of born neutral, and then you sin, and therefore you're a sinner. No, no, no. The Bible says no. You're a sinner. You are corrupt, and as a result of that, you do abominable deeds. And so when we, you know, pray on Sunday, and we're praying for a baby, we'll joke that this is a really cute little pagan. And yeah, that's what we mean. This is a little sinner, not because she has committed a sin yet, but she was born in sin. David would say, in sin my mother conceived me, and then they come out and they sin. But the idea of depravity is people do wicked things because since the fall, we are born with a wicked heart. In Adam's sin, we all fell. Okay, so it says that all people are evil. As a result, they do evil. We would say it this way. Sin is nature, not just nurture. You don't just learn how to sin. Now, we live in a society that says sin is nurture. Well, of course people are sinning. I mean, they're poor. They can't help it. They're uneducated. They can't help it. If we would put them in a nurturing environment, they would live differently. No, they would be well-fed, well-educated sinners. They would actually be more devious because they would be so much more capable. Okay, so the problem isn't nurture. And this flies against most of the world in their philosophy, but by nature we're born sinners. As a result, we sin. So by the time he gets done with this, he says the lost person is evil, therefore the lost person does evil. If you missed it, he says at the end of verse 1, there is none who does good. So he's talking about a universal problem. When we talk about depravity, every person in the world is a sinner, and every person is deeply, irreparably sinful. You're not as sinful as you could be, but your whole being, your mind, your will, your emotions, every part of you has been ravaged by sin. That's what we mean by depravity. And you always wonder, you know, we use these big words, what do they mean? Psalm 14. There's an anti-God bent, you're born that way, and then you act consistently with who you are, and that's all from verse 1. And then the rest, again, is just details. Okay, so you come to verse 2, we'll go quickly. The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. What does he find? All right, God is, I mean, and part of this is maybe picturesque. God is looking, you know, I'm looking for a righteous person. Who does he find? He finds verse 3. They have all turned aside. They have come together. They have become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one. Why does no one do good? Because no one is good. Okay, so you have this idea, and that's where my understanding is, you know, we sit here as saved people, and we're going to be categorized in the psalm as the righteous, as the redeemed. But when God looked at you before Christ, he saw you going astray just like everybody else in the world. That's where in John 4, when Jesus says, you know, that God is looking for people who will worship him in spirit and in truth. God is looking for worshipers. Okay, so God's in heaven looking for worshipers. Where did he find them? Doesn't find them. There are none. So he makes them out of sinful, depraved people through his grace, through salvation. But he doesn't find them. He makes them. All right? So there's nobody good. Paul's going to use that. I mean, Paul's so brilliant. But when he's making the case that we're all lost in sin, he says, I can't do any better than David did 1,000 years ago. And he quotes David under the inspiration of the Spirit. So he says, all these people do evil. And then verse 4, he has this rhetorical question. Have they no knowledge, all the evil doers who do two things? They eat up my people as they eat bread. That's where Brian was saying there's some trouble brewing. They eat up my people as they do bread. Very vivid imagery. They just treat people like crust. And they're chewing through us and there's all kinds of crumbs flying. You know, and you think of that as another depiction of wickedness. When we think of somebody seeking to devour, who do we think of? Well, Satan's like a lion seeking to devour. But the wicked are that way. So they're oppressing the righteous, and they do not call upon the Lord. Like, it never occurred to them that they need any assistance. They don't call on God. And we pause for a second. It's kind of like we talked about last week in Psalm 6. Don't get to the solution too fast. Sit there and just, Yeah, people are wicked, including us. And we're anti-God, and we hate the righteous in our natural bent unless something changes. And then we move on, and we kind of get to the aha moment. There they are in great terror. Who's in great terror? Who's in great terror? The wicked. There they are in great terror. What are they afraid of? There's no God. No, now reality sets. You know, the fact that you deny him doesn't change reality. There they are in great terror, for God is with the generation of the righteous. Okay, so what he's starting to talk about is there is an inevitable end coming where the wicked will be judged and the righteous will be rescued. So he says it in verse 5, there they are in great terror, the wicked. If they're not afraid, they should be, because they're sinners in the hands of an angry God, as John Edwards would say. Because God is with the generation of the righteous. What's he do with them? What do you mean he's with them? Why is it a help to know that God is with them? Because you just know if God is with them, he's going to act on their behalf. The best illustration I could come up with was, I'm a kid in sixth grade, and me and my scrawny friends are going home from school, and there's this eighth grader, and he just, in my little mind, he looked like a pro football player. The guy was just big compared to me, probably a little squeak, but big compared to me. And he's bullying me, and he's pushing, and he's wanting to fight. And I knew this wouldn't go well if I engaged him. And unbeknownst to him, my brother Jeff, my oldest brother, saw this. And he comes out and he says, hey, you want to go? I'll go. You guys get out of the way. You want to fight? I'll fight. And there was this moment in my mind like, Jeff, you always pick on me. You know, why all of a sudden are you offended that this guy's doing the very thing you do every day of your life? And if you have siblings, you know, you can pick on them. Nobody else can pick on them. And all of a sudden, he was with me and I was good. And I'll never forget. It just tells you something about the character of my brother, Jeff. He told me one time, he says, Chris, if you're going to be in a fight, somebody's going to throw the first punch. It might as well be you. That's not scriptural. That's the world according to Jeff. And they're standing there, you know, kind of the blustering, like, push, I'm tough, tough, tough. And Jeff just said, oh, forget it. Bam! And the guy's lip just blew up, blood everywhere. And not saying that was a good thing, but I was rescued. All right, he was with me. There's a point at which he doesn't even have to say exactly what's going to happen. These guys should be terrified because the Lord is with the righteous. That's all you need to know. Okay, and you can figure out what's going to happen from there. He's going to take a second run at it in verse 6. But he moves from they to you. So now he's preaching against the wicked. He says, you would shame or hurt the plans of the poor. You're oppressing the poor. But the Lord is the poor man's refuge. Okay, so there he actually gives more of a picture. He's not just with him, he's the refuge around him. He's going to take care of him. Okay, so you have kind of a mighty fortress is our God idea, where you have the wicked oppressing, Satan oppressing, but the Lord is our refuge and he's our protector. Okay, so we move through the folly of the wicked in verse 1, the depravity of the wicked, the end of verse 1 through verse 4, and then the terror of the wicked because of coming judgment. And then verse 7, you just have this patience that's needed. It says, oh, the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion. I know it's going to come. I just want it to hurry up and happen. Okay, so he doesn't even say if. Look what he says in verse 7. Oh, the salvation for Israel would come out of Zion when the Lord restores the fortune of his people, and he will. You know, maybe when I become king, but I know it's going to happen. Then let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. So the destruction of the wicked is going to happen. And the care for the righteous is going to happen. And now David just says, I need patience. In both senses of the term, you know, the biblical term patience means to bear under trial. But also means to bear with time and just like, God, this is going to happen. It's hard waiting. You know, the answer to verse 7 in the New Testament is, even so, Lord Jesus, come quickly. I know you're coming. I believe that. Now, Maranatha, do it and do it soon because we're getting eaten up like crust of bread. Come. And again, you don't get discouraged by the how long, O Lord, because not only is his plan perfect, but his timing is perfect. And, you know, there have been people who are calling on God, waiting, and sometimes they, you know, we talked about Sunday, Hebrews 11, sometimes they get killed by the sword. But judgment day is coming, and then that'll be a day of great praise. All right, so we've addressed Psalm 14. We basically addressed Psalm 53. Let me make two very, very quick applications. This psalm is not primarily describing you as the righteous person who is afflicted by the wicked. You and I are the rebels against God. There's no one righteous. We have sinned because we are sinners. That's us. And why is there a change? Because of mercy, because of grace, because of the gospel, in spite of us. So part of this, as dark as it is, it should move you to praise, where you say, God, thank you for not leaving me where I was. You intervened. I don't understand it, but I'm not going to fight about it or fret about it. I'm just going to say thank you for saving me. All right. The other one on a more theological level, I'm just going to kind of plant a seed. For me, anytime as a young person, anytime I would come to scriptures that talk about God's sovereignty in salvation. You know, I'd see the term election, predestination, something like that. It bugged me. It made me mad. And I thought my job was to explain that it didn't mean what it clearly means. So I'm going to explain away that word. And I did that for a long time, just kind of mishandling the scriptures. And I'm not telling you that you need to get, you know, a John Calvin tattoo or call yourself a Calvinist or what. But the difference for me, for the whole question of sovereignty, and it's still a mystery and God's smarter than me and I can live with that. But the difference maker was when I understood the depth of human depravity. This is the foundation. When you understand how sinful we are, and we're not pursuing God, we're not wanting to choose God. You know, the first sin, Adam and Eve heard God and they ran away. And there was only redemption because God pursued them. Okay, so when I understood there is no one seeking God, there's no one righteous. And they don't even have a little flicker of light that just needs to grow into a beam. Ephesians 2, they are dead. When that just settled on me, then any question of God doing a gracious act to bring life, I understood, like, wow, this isn't a matter of fair. Fair would be, y'all go to hell. That's fair. God in grace has opened the eyes of us. I don't understand it. Doesn't seem like a really good choice to me. But it made the question not so terrible to me to understand, wow, we are hard and dead and wicked and anti-God. We're not neutral. The fool, humanity, has said, no God, we're corrupt, we do evil, we oppress Him, we don't call on Him. And that's our natural state. And however God figures it out, thank God for sovereign grace. Thank God for that kind of initiating, undeserved mercy. And then when you consider like a passage like Ephesians 2 says, you are saved by grace through faith, and that's not your own doing. It's the gift of God. You start realizing, like, wow, yeah, I contributed nothing but the rebellion. You know, does that bug you? It used to bug me. Now I'm like, wow, thank you. And it moves me to worship, not to pride, but it should be to humility. God, thank you. So that's my experience. And Psalm 14 can actually drive you down deep into some hard doctrine, but it allows you to really soar to great heights of gratitude and praise. So hope it has that effect. So it's not such a dark psalm after all. All right, tonight we're going to break up for prayer. Instead of doing men and women, we're going to break up into groups of three or four just with people around you. And there are prayer sheets. Thank you to Marnie for keeping up with those. And we've mentioned a few other prayer requests. So let's remember those. And obviously continue to pray for the Hoffmans. But there's other needs. I told Lonnie on Sunday, you know, we haven't forgotten you. Praying for you, he has one treatment left. Don't forget him. There are some others in the church that just have some health concerns that they're not sure how they're going to turn out yet. So just keep praying for each other. All right. Thank you, Lord, for the study. Thank you for hearing our prayers now as we offer them. In Jesus' name, amen.